Let's just do a quick review. Nimble pickup. Well, I'm just going to go through both classes to kind of prime the pump a little bit very quickly. We talked about Thomas Aquinas and his life. Remember, he was a kind of paradigm of Christendom. And that is, he embodied a spiritual counterposition to the instincts, which was the necessary and useful contribution of Christianity to Western culture, but not without its problems. And we're heir to that, those problems, as was Thomas, or somebody like Thomas, namely that we've gotten so far away from the instincts that we need to get back to that world.
No.
The time is that
we
just need to close the door.
Thank you. Thanks. She's gonna yeah. Thanks for thinking of it. Then we talked a little bit about scholasticism, which was the discipline that Thomas excelled in, or was the epitome of, which is a very rationalized, very linear, very logical summation of what the central Christian tenets were. And the point there is that it was really the first large effort to kind of systematize what is Christianity. And he was part of that. That was Scholasticism. And remember, the method was very intellectual, very linear, and very organized. We talked a little bit about Sophia as being symbolized by starlight. We talked a little bit about Sophia as being symbolized by the dual model. Does that all sound familiar to everybody? Okay. Then the last week we got into continuing the discussion of Sophia conceptually, and I just tried to give you a very rough, very basic idea, which we're going to elaborate on again, come back to it again and again throughout the course, that Sophia is a knowing of the pattern of your fate. A knowing. It's of the pattern of your fate. It's as if there is an active agency in you that knows this. This isn't so much to be thought of as a plan, but a knowing of the plan. In other words, sorry, Mary, I pushed the wrong button. Not so much a knowledge, but a knowing of the plan. So that when you are in a position to begin to try to understand this dimension of your life, this inborn identity sense of your life, it's a dynamic enterprise, because you come in contact not with a knowledge, but with another knower. And just like any friendship eventually leads to conflict, so does the confrontation with wisdom. And that will be the substance of our material. Again, just very introductory stuff. Then we got talking about dreams, and I think I discussed, four dreams. I discussed a dream of mine in which Sophia was symbolized by starlight. I discussed actually two dreams about starlight. One was another dreamer's. And in that other dream, the image of salmon color emerged, and that was important because Sophia is in, when you try to become aware of this inborn pattern of your fate, you begin swimming against the stream, because the whole world is organized by what normal is considered to be and what one does, but the Sophia business is about who you are. And that very often puts you in collision with the way things are. And that's symbolized by the salmon. We talked about the board game. Remember the reason that was related to Sophia was if you look at the etymology, not the etymology, the anthropology of board games, the way early peoples understood them, they were thought to be a reflection on Earth of activities in heaven. So that the moves in the board game were analogous to moves in heaven, and by watching the moves of a board game, for example, you could get an idea what the gods were doing, or vice versa, what the gods were doing could influence what was going on in the board game. So you've got the same idea of the dual dimension. And in that dream, which I really would encourage you to let that image work on you. The theme was people going around manically scooping up board games to possess themselves. And I thought that was a very rich and very accurate description of what's ailing us today. If you take that board game as the dialogue with this other knowing factor, the materialistic and power-oriented drive that moves our society is based around trying to grasp and control that dialogue rather than to be affected by it. So we are really living in a secular time where the basic thrust of our economic life is to exert control and gain rather than to enter into a dialogue. And the less we enter into a dialogue, the more we want to control and gain. We'll see more collective images, but that's certainly, I think, a very accurate description of our time. We talked a little bit about the dual mandala again in the dream where the woman goes up to the moon. She comes back down. Remember the dream immediately preceding that was when she had a diamond pulled out of her vagina. And we talked about that as, we took that as an entry point, really, for this other dimension of Sophia, that you get to know this knower, not abstractly, but in the confusion of daily life, the tragedies of daily life, and in the messes that your own physical desire, if you have the courage to follow it, will lead you into. That's pretty much where we stopped. Does that sound familiar? What we'll do today then is pick up on do some more dreams. Then we'll kind of step back a little bit, and we'll just have a very general look at the outline of the book, outline of the study guide, so you have it roughly in your mind what's ahead. And then we'll start with the book and look at probably till we get through to it today. We won't probably get much farther than a very careful look at wisdom historically through the last 2,500 years. Yeah.
When's the last class we will have before summer break?
This is the first week in June. Did I tell you that?
Yeah.
Did anyone write it down?
I didn't.
I don't know.
Yeah.
June 3rd.
And then we'll pick up again probably September. After Labor Day. One correction I do want to make. I realized I made a mistake in that one dream. Somebody picked it up and I misunderstood it. The one dream of the woman who had the coat on, remember that? I don't know if you remember that. Just reread it to you. Where is that? I've been sitting in the stands at some sporting event. I have my black jacket with me. Actually, it wasn't stars painted on the jacket. It was the color of the stars that were on the dreamer's niece. The dreamer was painting the nursery of the niece. But I think that it doesn't really change the meaning. Actually, it makes it a little bit more graphic. What a pale representation of this Sophia light the dreamer was living. It wasn't even the real stars. It was just a paint reflection of that.
What color is that? Like a yellow?
Well, it would have been like a yellow-white probably for the stars.
I guess I wonder about that because so many things are yellowish or yellow-white. I mean, how did it just zero in on, you know?
It's the same color as some of the stars I'm painting on the wall of my niece's nursery.
Okay, so that was her relation to
it. That was her comment.
I see.
Right. Another image of Sophia. We will get to a direct image of Sophia, but these are more subtle symbolic hints. I'll just read you the dream. It's very short. And you tell me what the Sophia image is and why.
This is a new dream.
This is a new dream. Dream of a female. I see the DNA double helix sort of suspended in midair in front of my dresser. I think I go back to sleep for a few minutes. I wake up again and see a red spider crawling up the front edge of the dresser and walking across the top of it. Now, it sounds like I'll read it again. I see the DNA double helix sort of suspended in midair in front of my dresser. So it sounds like the dreamer kind of woke up and had a hypnagogic image, sort of saw this half awake. And then she goes back to sleep. And I wake up again and see a red spider crawling up the front edge of the dresser and walking across the top of it.
Did you want to know?
Well, where's the Sophia image in there?
Mm-hmm. The double helix? Infinity?
The pattern of life is the DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And also the spider weaves the pattern, the mandala pattern. So that's another. We've talked about that. Sophia weaves the pattern of life just like the spider weaves a web.
Yeah. You see, the DNA is the physical blueprint of your being. So if you take it as a metaphor, it's the psychological blueprint of your being. And the spider here, I took it a little negatively. The spider also kills after it is fertilized. So it's a pretty classic example of the destructive feminine. And the dreamer's mother was such a woman. And the emergence of your own truth can also activate all those forces in you against it. All those voices would say, don't be, don't do. I don't think so. No. Remember, Sophia is just one dimension of the feminine. That is to say, there is another dimension of the feminine, which would be the spider. That would be Hecate, or in India, Kali. Yeah. But I don't know of any representation of Sophia that's negative.
Well, that's why I understand what you're saying. You know, you have it's just. Sophia is one aspect of the feminine.
Yeah.
So spider would be another
aspect. Spider is another aspect of the feminine. Right. Yeah. And I wanted to show you how often when you get in touch with this Sophia material, it starts a war. Because sometimes, in a way I'm not sure I can explain to you, we'll see coming up, Sophia is the healing factor, which just is given to you. And sometimes she is present, but then a lot of forces in the personality come into life to try to stop that. And there are all those forces that tell you you shouldn't do this, that, you know, you're wasting your money, you're wasting your time, you're not getting anywhere, everyone else is doing this and that, but you're not, and so on. I'm sure you know those voices. So that's how I took the spider. I'll pass this around. It's a drawing the dreamer did of the dream. Just have a look at it. This is a dream of a individual that I had worked with for a while, and we kind of reached a stopping point. Oh yeah, you hold it with the hold it vertically with the road at the bottom, with the road entry at the bottom. Hold it vertically. Yeah. Like a fallopian tube, sort of.
Like a Mobius strip.
I don't know that, Tom. Oh, I see. Uh huh.
A way of presenting a three-dimensional in the two-dimensional program.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of like an optical illusion. Right, because it said DNA helix, which...
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, this is for a second dream. This is this is another dream coming up. No, this didn't apply. Sorry, this does not apply to that first dream.
Spider on there.
No.
Yeah, I was looking for the dresser, and I thought, I don't see a dresser.
All right, sorry to make that clear. No.
You said fallopian tubes, but it could also be...
I guess it depends where your mind resides. I think I'll let that one go.
Moving right along.
This dream coming up is a dream of a female. We worked together for a while. She reached a sort of goal. I hadn't seen her for a couple of years. She kind of got in to a funk. She's pretty successful professionally, but just got bored and listless, and then had this dream. And then eventually called me, as you'll see. I was at a ceremony of some sort. There was an Eastern quality to the event. It included a fire which left a ring of powder. After the event, people, including myself, were touring the site. We stayed on a path. Some of the tourists had a disinterested attitude and were even a bit disrespectful of what seemed to be a religious site. Periodically, someone priest-like would enter the central stage area to place or take an object. I felt solemn and calm. I woke up retaining the calm feeling, and immediately I thought of calling Gary. So out of the stream, she returned to some analytic work again. Now, I think we know enough. You can make a stab at that one. Where is the Sophia image?
Respect. Her respect for me.
No. Mm-hmm. That's part of it, but it's not the Sophia image.
We had a fire. Did we have a tree?
Look at the picture.
Yeah.
Two circles.
Oh, two circles. Oh.
Double mandala. Mm-hmm. You see how these things are subtleties. When you get to know the general pattern, and then you have to be able to see how the dream plays with them.
Gary, could you read where it talks about two circles again in the dream?
Well, I'll just read you the whole dream again. I was at a ceremony of some sorts. Some sort. There was an Eastern quality to the event. It included a fire which left a ring of powder. Now, that fire leaving a ring of powder is it's on that right circle. After the event, people, including myself, were touring the site. We stayed on a path. Some of the tourists had a disinterested attitude and were even a bit disrespectful of what seemed to be a religious site. Periodically, someone, priest-like, would enter the central stage area to place or take an object. I felt solemn and calm. I woke up retaining the calm feeling and immediately thought of calling Gary. So she drew the... she drew it.
Okay.
And she drew the fire on the right side, and she drew then the empty space on the left with a circle in it, which would be like the one of the staging areas. See, there are two staging areas. There's a staging area on the left and a staging area on the right. Staging area on the right has the fire. And then the path that she talks about is what forms the pattern in the dream. So what's the dream telling us? Go to the fire. What's that fire about?
Purification, burning away.
Well, see, it's burning down. There's only ashes left.
Destruction.
Remember my description of her.
Burned out.
Yeah. See, that is the fire that had been burning. and she's burning out, and she's just feeling life is like there's ash left. So those ashes are symbolic of her, I wouldn't say despair, but sometimes it got pretty bad. I'd say more ennui and depression. Now, how would you explain this to such a person? Take what you know now and imagine she's sitting here. What would you say to her? I want to give you a feeling that this stuff, huh?
Call Gary.
Well, Gary's got the flu.
I'm thinking of like, to me, a path is always important. And it doesn't necessarily say she gets off the path, but I think it's interesting if they're all aspects of herself, then maybe there's some aspects of herself that are showing disrespect to her path in life.
Definitely.
Or something.
That's for sure. You can see. See, that's the spider. That's the equivalent of the spider in the last dream.
Oh,
no. That's what that spider voice is.
It's spiders aren't always that, though.
Boy, well, most of the time they are, I think.
Mm-hmm. I don't seem like that either.
Yeah. I don't know. I had
a positive female, positive Native American.
I had a whole series of weaver. I had a whole series of spider
voices. Yeah. It depends on the level of consciousness of the dreamer. And for a level of consciousness that is vulnerable, they're generally negative. And you can see the vulnerability here in the burnt down fire and in the disrespect. So that disrespect is a result of weakness. We disrespect what we don't understand. So you've got a situation of somewhat of a fragile ego.
She knows it's deep value. She's a dream ego.
She does, but she pretty easily will flip into the other side. Mm-hmm. Right. But still, here's somebody coming to you for the first hour, and they're saying, I'm really having a hard time, and they bring you this dream. What do you say to them?
You're in luck. There's a path that's unfolding for you. Mm-hmm. There's a story behind the leitmotif that you're living.
Okay, and what's that story?
Her purpose.
And where?
Why she's here.
Where is that symbolized in the dream?
Isn't it the image of the circle?
Which circle?
Oh, the one that's empty.
Right. See, that's the key point. That circle is empty. And that's why she's feeling despair. So I would say to her pretty much what we've said, that we know. I mean, here I think you can, with most intelligent people, you can just go into a little bit of mythology. We know that mandalas represent images of wholeness. And the irony in that is, in many religious traditions, that image of wholeness is actually two images. And it's two images because there are two dimensions to life. There's the dimension of time and space, and there's this other dimension where we assume in our work that our identity is a given in there somewhere, and we our task is to discover it and bring it into being. And the reason you're feeling bad, it shows up in the dream in two places. One, the fire burning down. So that feeling bad that you told me about is symbolized by the ash. The other reason you're feeling bad is in the other side, there is no information yet. So all you're feeling is the emptiness on the right-hand circle, and there's nothing on the left-hand circle yet to give you some idea where to go from here. So the dream really is a picture of despair, of the old going and the new not yet announcing itself. Very hopeful, I think, is also, Nancy, you're rightly say, in that we know these dual mandalas come up when the issue is discovering that inborn self and bringing it over into time and space. So there you can see how then we work with this archetypal idea that these images, when they appear, have somewhat of a consistent meaning. The other thing I think, I didn't say it to her, but maybe I should have, I don't know. Part of you disrespects this.
Disrespects.
Right. Part of you disrespects yourself.
Oh, I thought you
meant
your preference.
Same.
Okay.
Same.
Didn't you say that she stood back and watched the
the monk of her that would come in and out.
And there's also part of her, part of her is going into this question, and part of her is standing back laughing at it. It's ambivalence.
Putting things in and taking things out.
Right.
I would say that's pretty typical. I mean,
it's very typical.
You don't get a whole embrace. Oh, God, the old is gone, the new one is gone.
Exactly.
You know, you get this tug
very
and pull,
typical.
But some people never move through.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, I don't think moving through it makes it disappear.
No.
You just get sterilized.
Yeah. See, that the danger is that the disrespectful sides will come up and take control. That's the danger. So, but the dream shows you a whole panorama of sides. I don't want to emphasize one over the other. It shows that the tendency to go into the problem. It shows the tendency to laugh at the problem. It shows, and I think this was the immediate. This is the immediate curative effect of the dream, if you will, that when you come in a situation like this, you're saying, you know, I'm feeling bad. What's wrong with me? Is there something wrong with me for feeling this way? And the dream says, no, you're feeling exactly what's going on. So in a funny way, the dream confirms her feelings and also gives her this hopeful archetypal image that this is a beginning. It feels like an end, but it's really a beginning.
Too,
that you
don't feel like you're isolated. You know.
Is what? I didn't hear what you said.
Yeah.
Yeah, but this is a classic initial dream. You see, you can see an enormous amount of what's going to be portended in the therapy. And we don't want to be negative, but we don't want to be naive. We don't know whether she's going to get through that ambivalence or not. And it's still a battle. Yeah.
Isn't there I'm not sure fantasy is the correct word, but a thinking in our society that one is always supposed to be happy, so therefore, if you've had analysis for 4 years, if you have a funk, there's something the matter with you. I mean, I hear that, and the ability to accept that we cut ourselves up when we start having a downtime.
Mm-hmm. And you see, those voices that cut her up are the people laughing. She couldn't value her own darkness as a necessary phase and really a prelude to this new beginning, which hasn't surfaced yet. And I think, too, you know, to be fair, that's the scary part, that you feel you're dying, but you don't know where the rebirth's going to come from. But the dream says it'll be there. Otherwise, it wouldn't put out in that image. It's just not, you just aren't getting the information yet. Again, in that very obscure dream, you know, of these two paths, once you know the Sophia imagery, it's an enormous help for helping explain. Otherwise, I don't know how you'd get across the depths of the dream, because these archetypal images always clothe themselves in very banal images. But if you know the form, you can go back to the form. And if you know the form, you can go back to the image and explain what the form is about.
So if she were to be able to help herself, then she would need to accept the fact that that old face was dying, but to not be cynical, to have hope that something will surface, or does this mean that she should take some sort of an action and go looking for something different in her life?
Good point. I think the dream gives us a clue. There was an Eastern quality to the event. What do you make of that? Yeah, it's very much awaiting. Emphasized here.
Right. So then, in her case, if she just has hope and is not cynical and goes through her suffering dark phase, the new phase will appear.
Exactly.
She doesn't have to.
She
go
doesn't
out.
Have to do it.
She doesn't have to go out looking.
Right.
Well,
that's encouraging.
The verbosity. Mm-hmm. You know, almost your path can almost be your anointing, your suffering.
Is that the meaning of that mark, that the ash is the...
Yeah, well, it's a blessing, but it's like the ash is a blessing, so that's what... When you
say
the ash first, it's sort of what
I hadn't thought of that, but I'm sure there's something to that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you see the, you know, well, I don't want to get us too far off track, but this Eastern quality... I always think of that term Wu Wei. Did you ever come across that? W-U-W-E-I. It means actively not doing. It's a beautiful concept that you wait attentively. You don't wait passively. You wait actively. Easier said than done.
Can you give us an example? I mean, just not of anything you've seen, but just out of your head of a good example that might be an example of somebody waiting actively.
Well, that you realize you've got a problem, that you want a solution, and that you look in your dreams and you look in outer events and synchronistic occurrences, what is coming your way.
And you're just assuming then that it will open up.
It will open up. But I think, you know, you could have dreams where there was a hero and a dragon, and then you would say, well, your job is to go out and beat the bushes. But the dreams very directly give you advice. No, your job is to be receptive.
And what occurred to me is the left side, which is the feminine side, the receptive side.
Uh-huh.
That was what I was thinking.
Definitely.
About. The other side is the more masculine.
Right. See, it's on the masculine side that the fire is not working anymore. The fire is, the passion in conscious living is dwindling. Couple more. This is from Ego and Archetype. Most of these are from my practice, but I came across these two one from Edinger and one from Jung, which are also very lovely, I think. You'll see. Now you're not going to hear anything new. This is just going to give you more examples of what we've been talking about. This is from Ego and Archetype, page 119. It was though I was experiencing the dream on two levels simultaneously. On the one hand, it was unique, spontaneous, and unrehearsed. On the other hand, I seemed also to be playing a role in reenacting a story I had once known but forgotten. The two levels were inextricably connected. I was playing the role perfectly just because I was really living it at the same time. I made up my lines as I went along, but I seemed to be helped by the fact that I had once known the story. That's the once known business, that's Sophia. And the story is very much Sophia. When each situation came up, it struck some chord of memory which came to my assistance. So the whole idea that we've been here before. Another dream of Jung, Psychology of the Transference, paragraph 377. A beautiful little child, a girl of 6 months old, is playing in the kitchen with her grandparents and myself. Her mother. The grandparents are on the left of the room, and the child stands on the squared table in the middle of the kitchen. I stand by the table and play with the child. The old woman says she can hardly believe we have known the child for only 6 months. I say it is not so strange because we knew and loved the child long before it was born. Again, that idea of things having been here first. I said most of the time dreams don't come knocking saying I'm a Sophia dream. Here's a dream that comes knocking saying I'm a Sophia dream. Also, I think an image of our time and related to those chess, those game board thieves. Dreamer's Mail. I am somehow in a relationship with an extremely powerful man. He's showing me how his business works, as though I am to be initiated into it. He scares me. Here comes the punchline. His business involves intimidating competitors and underlings and lavishly rewarding family members and peers. That's the evil greed of our time. It's just about everybody. His business involves intimidating competitors and underlings and lavishly rewarding family members and peers. He is very evil. I'm wanting to get away, but can't break free from our relationship. Then suddenly this big black woman appears, walking out of an opening of light, like Christ in some icons of Holy Saturday, in the depths of hell, ransoming the damned. She's big, broad, and black, and full of great woman energy. And she just walks up to the man, and my relationship with him is dissolved. I can't take my eyes off of her. She just galvanizes me, and all else is secondary. She's very good. I will call her Mama Christ. It feels like Mrs. Jung has more power than Mama Christ, even. But Mama Christ saves and loves me, while Mrs. Jung advises and loves me. I love them both. There is the healing aspect. When you know who you really are, you don't need to intimidate people anymore. And that image came to him and guided him out of his own power drive. Mrs. Jung will be a reference to the therapy.
That was a man's dream?
It's a man's dream. Okay, hopefully you have some idea of Sophie conceptually and Sophie in dreams. Anything you want to chew on? Yeah.
I just thought a comment on the first dream of those last three that you read about knowing the blind because she's deaf.
Yeah.
I must have had that dream in different aspects a dozen times or more in your life.
That's probably why you're here.
I think it's interesting.
They're pleasant.
Very pleasant. This is the healing aspect of the unconscious.
Remember it when you wake up, other than
that it happened.
Or it's like dreaming music.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a dream similar to that too, and I remember reading something from Virginia Woolf's diary of the days that she could really go out and do well in her writing. She would see a beautiful park and it would seem to come alive, and then she could see the park below that park that was more real, and the one below that, and the one below that, and those were the ways that she could come in and just feel like what she was writing was really there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How about your client we were talking about back a little bit earlier that was having the thing of the two
circles, right.
Okay, is that what calls Robert Moore calls liminality? Would that be an example of being in a stage of holding or the next step to occur?
Yeah, I think that's actually a word from anthropology. And it refers to the initiation process when the boys are and girls are separated from their parents, but they haven't yet become adults. Right.
Liminality. Going back to the word origins is a word meaning the threshold of the doorway.
Right.
You're crossing from one side of the room into the next room on the threshold. That's an ancient word. Lamin is the name for threshold.
Well, hopefully I've given you some sense of Sophia and also of Jungian psychology, that this is where we try to start. We don't try to start with developmental schema. We don't try to work with concepts of what is normal. We try to start with the mystery. Who are you? Who were you put here to be? It's that simple and it's that complicated. To me, that's what distinguishes Jung's work from other works. There are no concepts. There's only the reality that you were put here to be, and we work with that assumption and we try to find out who that person is. And that person will have good aspects, bad aspects, healthy aspects, not healthy aspects, developmentally sound aspects, developmentally unsound aspects, and so on. It's the bigger picture that we're going for. And so this course on Sophia is going to be an attempt to see how is that knowledge symbolized. Sophia would be the representation of that knowledge. Let's look a little bit about how this text came to be. On the study guide now, I'm on page one, editing the text. If you are interested, you don't worry about following along. But this is what she talks about in the book. In part one, chapters 1, 2, 4, 5, and 6, I'm going to summarize it very briefly for you from her descriptions of this book in a book called Alchemy, An Introduction to the Symbolism in Psychology by Bonfrance, published by Inner City in 1980. She gives a nice couple paragraphs, and it gives us a history of how this text came to be. She says that Jung came across the text first in another part that we're not really concerned with. It was basically a strictly chemical, alchemical recipe. And he did some digging around and found a copy in the Central Library in Zurich, where it had been placed after spending quite a few centuries in a monastery on Lake Constance, which is the lake between Switzerland and Germany. So he then came across this Aurora Consurgens text and handed it over to Bonfrance, who became curious, and she started digging around European libraries, found a copy in Paris, copy in Bologna, and a copy in Venice. And all of the versions, you know, some were clear in some parts, some were clear in others, so she tried to get as many texts as she could to put together one complete text. Most of them ascribed the authorship to Thomas Aquinas on the text, although I think that kind of flew in the face of traditional Thomistic scholarship. So she and Jung sat down together to try and figure out what it was, and Jung's first thought was that it was a product of a schizophrenia, or a manic phase of a manic depressive psychosis, or a record of somebody who was overwhelmed by the unconscious, who wasn't crazy. So the overwhelming wasn't making them crazy, but they were still given an onslaught by the unconscious. So when she began to look at it more closely, she, as we will see, paid very close attention to the death marriage, the marriage theme, which comes at the end of the thing, as if to suggest that this thing had something to do with a dying person. And that could resonate, we will see, with the life of Thomas Aquinas. So she began to think maybe this whole business of it being ascribed to Thomas Aquinas wasn't totally false. Because remember we talked about how on his last days he whacked his head. Remember he was riding on his donkey, whacked his head. And I forget, somewhere near Naples he was placed in a monastery, and he lived about 3 or 4 months after that. And at that time, the brothers in that monastery approached him for, you know, being the church authority that he was, and asked him to give them a sermon or a treatise on Song of Songs. We'll see that. It's a book of the Old Testament. And the Song of Song imagery is very, very much alive in the parts of Aurora Consurgens. So that's what led her to the conjecture that this may have been one of the notes taken down as Thomas was on his deathbed, but it is very close in content to those Song of Songs. She then, you know, she got her PhD in classical languages, so she was in a position to give a kind of authoritative translation of the text, and with Jung's help decided to publish it. So that's how the text came to be. Jung really found it in a weird version, in a partial version. She did a lot of digging, found it in many other versions. They kind of put it together that it is very probably, given the content and the fact that it was traditionally, that it was in these other versions described to Thomas Aquinas, that it could very well be some of his last thoughts, or a record of some of his last experience.
Isn't that the kind of thing that the church would have tried to have covered up?
Oh yeah, this was not.
So popular. It's just luck, or you know, that it's quite likely that it's forces or the church tried to do away with it.
Yeah, she said her work has been completely ignored by the church, except for one monk. I think she said she talked to, thought it was very plausible. But basically, it's going to be against the traditional understanding of what Christendom is, so they would have to be a little unnerved by it, right? And remember that Thomas said at the end of his life, you know, all that I've written up to now has been stalled. Remember that when he mm-hmm. kind of went into a trance on the mass that day. So it's very possible that this is all the material that was building up inside him prior to that kind of breakthrough, and then it broke through in that event. Just, and that's just a real rough, quick trip through the how this book came to be and how she got to work on it. Let me give you a quick tour of the book and then the study guide. Now, the text of Aurora Consurgens is first printed in English and in Latin, and that makes up the pages up to 149. So all of this stuff here, let me show you, all of this here, that's just the text. Her work on the text then starts on 153. So this is her work on the text. She goes through the book, passage by passage, and interprets it. So all the text that is printed here has been reprinted here. So you don't have to really worry about this stuff. This is just the whole thing in continuous form. But all of this is repeated paragraph by paragraph I'll call it the interpretation of the part of the book. That's the first thing to realize, why we'll be starting kind of in the middle of the book. Because the first part is just the text in Latin and in English. A good one, a good third of it, a good fourth of it. The interpretation is in two parts. And the first five chapters are an introduction to the interpretation. And that goes from page 153 to 216. That's about this much of the book. In that first section, we are introduced to wisdom. And wisdom is just described. And we're going to go through that section pretty fast, so you know. And that takes up about a third of the book. If you put what I've described so far, the text itself, and then the first part of the interpretation is about the first third of the book. The real meat of the book starts on page 217. And there we're going to slow down and go quite carefully. The meat of the book is 12 parables. And those 12 parables will be what happens in the man's psyche who had these visions when he's confronted with Sophia. So the first five chapters are the presentation of the experience. And the next 12 chapters are the reaction of this man's psyche to the experience. And they will represent his attempt to come to grips with the experience, or to be a little bit more precise, the reactions of the psyche to help him come to grips with this experience and understand it. So if you kind of keep that broad outline in mind, it might help you a little bit. And then this is the part we'll go very closely through. The study guide. How to use the study guide. You go to the table of contents. The main part of this class will be an examination of Section A. Section A is the study guide to the book. And you see I've divided the study guide up in the opening comments, which we're still working on, and then the first five chapters, which we'll go through closely, which we will not go through carefully. We'll go through pretty fast. And this next, did I say seven parables? Is it seven parables? I said 12. I don't remember. It might be. It's seven parables, sorry. Yeah, it's seven parables. 12 chapters altogether. So that's basically what we'll be working from, Section A. Section B I'll talk a little bit more about in a second. What I try to do there is summarize the main points in the book. So Section B is really just a summary of all the main ideas. And it's, I don't know, it's about 8 pages. But we're going to be, at times, it's going to seem like there's so much material that you can kind of lose the thread. So I've tried to give you the thread. And so I just went through the main paragraphs of her interpretation, which summed up what she'd been saying, and I typed them up for you. So you can kind of follow along and not feel you're getting lost in the wealth of details. So Section A is the main part of the main part of work. Section B is a summary of what we will be saying. Now, from time to time, we're going to take detours. And the next C, D, E, F, G, and H are detours. At a certain point, I'll say, now we're talking about this point. Let's go to Section C, let's go to Section D, and so on. So that is all reference material. And I'll direct you to it when we get there. But we've already really taken one detour, whether you realize it or not, when we talk about number and time. And we'll take another detour today to get started off with when we look at Section C, Wisdom. So think of the main section as A, and then B is summary, and then C, D, E, F, G, H, just detours that we'll take to enrich enrich what we're doing. I'll just mention what's ahead. We'll look today still. We'll get to it pretty soon, I think. We'll look at wisdom historically. Wisdom is a biblical image, and it has a history. She has a history. So we'll look at that history. So you can see not only psychologically what her reality is, but historically what her reality is and how close they are. What we're making of it psychologically is very close to how she's been understood historically. So that's the wisdom. Number and time we've already done. I put that in there so you have some thoughts about Sophia. As we'll see down the road, what I'm going to call the Sophia dimension of reality got Jung to reevaluate everything. And so we're going to be looking at the historical development of his concept of the archetype, because that changed around Sophia. And he changed his concept of the archetype to take account of these Sophia experiences. So that's what that detour will be in. Section F is just a little couple of quotes, which we'll refer to briefly, where it's where the Unus Mundus is talked about. These are just texts to help us amplify and enlarge the material. For your information, Section G, and you might want to make a note, in the book, Part 1, Chapter 3, it's a glossary of who's who. So if you're reading along and you see Aldifius or something, you say, who the heck is he? You can look it up. That's just more for your own edification. You can look up or not look up as you want. Sometimes it's kind of interesting to know who's who. And like some alchemy websites if you want to read up on alchemy and so on. There's a brief history of alchemy, which we will look at too. Again, all reference material. Section H is the Song of Songs, because that biblical book will come up quite a bit in this text as a reference. She will allude to it. She'll say, well, this is like the Song of Songs. And I want to then spend a little time looking at that text together so you kind of know what's the main biblical text in back of this story. Song of Songs. Now, Section I, if you are a dreamer, and you're watching your dreams, Section I is my little index of all the main images in the book. So if you have a prison dream or a peacock dream or a ear dream or something like that, and you care to share it with us, I'd be glad to keep a file. Or you might want to check it for your own reference. But this Section I is an index to all the main images in Aurora Consurgence text or brought in by Von Franz as she amplifies the text to bring some practical examples to the table. If you've got one you want to share on this theme, why, please feel free. And if not, you can use it for your own reference. Am I going too fast? Okay, so one more thing and then we'll take a break. And that is how to use a study guide. So if you go back to page 1, the last thing I want to mention is the notation convention. Basically, Aurora Consurgens is an interpretation of these visions. And she does the interpretation paragraph by paragraph. So she presents a paragraph of the text, and then she interprets it. Presents another paragraph of the text, and then interprets it. So what we're going to do is simply look at each paragraph and read it aloud. So we really hear what the text is about. And you can think of it as the same way we do dream work. We hear the dream, even eyes closed sometimes, and feel it. Really let it sink in. You know, really get a feeling inside what images are coming up. And then we'll interpret them. So what I have done in the study guide, if you want to go ahead a page or so, I have listed with C text, a listing for each paragraph that's discussed. So you go to page 2. I've given you the first couple of words. Good night.
That's the first
words of the first text, and you can go to 157 if you want it to shuttle back and forth, and we will read that text aloud, and then I have tried to divide. I don't know if this is going to make it better or worse, but because there's so much information in the book, I've tried to divide up her interpretation into comments on the images. And then just general psychological comment. So where she is giving a discussion, an interpretation of the image, I've then listed image, and I've listed what the image is. So like we'll start off, we'll read the text, which begins with all good things. And the main image in that text is the south and the south wind. So we'll read the text, we'll focus on the image I've listed, and then we'll look at her interpretation. So it's kind of, that would be the main thing we do. Read the text, look for the main image, and then hear her interpretation. Look for the text, hear the main image or images, and then hear her interpretation. Sometimes she takes little detours. Sometimes she takes big detours. And I have listed those as commentary. So she doesn't really talk about the text so much as she does use it as a starting point for some general discussion. So, text, and then either a discussion of an image or a discussion of a commentary. That will be how we structure our time. Also, as I mentioned, from time to time, I'm going to summarize. We'll stop and we'll summarize what she's said. I've given you the first couple of lines of that summary in capital italics. We'll read that, and there'll be a little place to stop and say, "Are we on track here?" And I've given you the first couple of words in this section, and then I've typed the whole thing up in the section B, so you can. We'll discuss it here, but then you can keep a running commentary of all the summaries so you don't get lost. Is this making sense to everybody? Mm-hmm. I think that'll help. Because the problem is you start talking about all this stuff and pretty soon everything becomes everything. And you forget where you are. Then you can always go back to the summary and remember where you are. I have tried for at least for the 7 parables to give you the main image of each section. Again, so we don't lose the forest for the trees. And every once in a while she says something that I think is particularly important, and I've made a note of that. So text, image, interpretation, or text, commentary, and then other little goodies thrown in there, summaries to kind of help you keep straight, and main images to keep us on track from time to time. The problem with working with unconscious material this rich is you get so deep into it, you forget what you're reading. And I've tried to give you a way to keep your mind focused while still delving into the text. Does that make sense, everybody? Okay, let's have a stretch.